Chapter 100. We should have had no chapter for political young gentlemen, for ladies would have neither known nor cared what kind of monster a political young gentleman was. But as this good custom in common with many others has gone out, apostrophe and left no word, when it is likely to be home again, as political young ladies are by no means rare, and political young gentlemen the very reverse of scarce, we are bound in the strict discharge of our most responsible duty, not to neglect this natural division of our subject. If the political young gentleman be resident in a country town, and there are political young gentlemen in country towns sometimes, he is wholly absorbed in his politics, as a pair of purple spectacles communicate the same uniform tint to all objects near and remote, so the political glasses, with which the young gentleman assists his mental vision, give to everything the hue and tinge of party feeling. The political young gentleman would as soon think of being struck with the beauty of a young lady in the opposite interest, as he would dream of marrying his sister to the opposite member. If the political young gentleman be a conservative, he has usually some vague ideas about Ireland and the Pope which he cannot very clearly explain, but which he knows are the right sort of thing, and not to be very easily got over by the other side. He has also some choice sentences regarding church and state, culled from the banners in use at the last election, with which he intersperses his conversation at intervals with surprising effect. But his great topic is the Constitution, upon which he will declaim, by the hour together, with much heat and fury, not that he has any particular information on the subject, but because he knows that the Constitution is somehow church and state, and church and state somehow the Constitution, and that the fellows on the other side say it isn't, which is quite a sufficient reason for him to say it is, and to stick to it. Perhaps his greatest topic of all, though, is the people. If a fight takes place in a populous town, in which many noses are broken, and a few windows, the young gentleman throws down the newspaper with a triumphant air, and exclaims, "Here's your precious people!" If half a dozen boys run across the course at race time, when it ought to be kept clear, the young gentleman looks indignantly round, and begs you to observe the conduct of the people. If the gallery demand a hornpipe between the play and the afterpiece, the same young gentleman cries no and shame till he is hoarse, and then inquires with a sneer, "What do you think of popular moderation now?" In short, the people form a never-failing theme for him, and when the attorney, on the side of his candidate, dwells upon it with great power of eloquence at election time, as he never fails to do, the young gentleman and his friends, and the body they head, cheer with great violence against the other people, with whom, of course, they have no possible connection. In much the same manner the audience at a theater never fail to be highly amused with any jokes at the expense of the public always laughing heartily at some other public, and never at themselves. If the political young gentleman be a radical, he is usually a very profound person indeed, having great store of theoretical questions to put to you, with an infinite variety of possible cases and logical deductions therefrom. If he be of the utilitarian school too, which is more than probable, he is particularly pleasant company, having many ingenious remarks to offer upon the voluntary principle and various cheerful disquisitions connected with the population of the country, the position of Great Britain in the scale of nations, and the balance of power. Then he is exceedingly well versed in all doctrines of political economy as laid down in the newspapers, and knows a great many parliamentary speeches by heart. Nay, he has a small stock of aphorisms, none of them exceeding a couple of lines in length, which will settle the toughest question, and leave you nothing to say. He gives all the young ladies to understand that Miss Martin knows the greatest woman that ever lived. And when they praise the good looks of Mr. Hawkins, the new member, says he's very well for a representative, all things considered, But he wants a little calling to account, and he is more than half afraid it will be necessary to bring him down on his knees for that vote on the miscellaneous estimates. At this, the young ladies express much wonderment, and say surely a member of Parliament is not to be brought upon his knees so easily, in reply to which the political young gentleman smiles sternly, and throws out dark hints regarding the speedy arrival of that day, when members of Parliament will be paid salaries, and required to render weekly accounts of their proceedings, at which the young ladies utter many expressions of astonishment and incredulity, while their lady mothers regard the prophecy as little else than blasphemous. It is extremely improving and interesting to hear two political young gentlemen, of diverse opinions, discuss some great question across a dinner table, such as, whether, if the public were admitted to Westminster Abbey for nothing, they would or would not convey small chisels and hammers in their pockets, and immediately set about chipping all the noses off the statues, or whether, if they once got into the Tower for a shilling, they would not insist upon trying the crown on their own heads, and loading and firing off all the small arms in the armory, to the great discomposure of Whitechapel and the Minories. Upon these, and many other momentous questions which agitate the public mind in these desperate days, they will discourse with great vehemence and irritation for a considerable time together, both leaving off precisely where they began, and each thoroughly persuaded that he has got the better of the other. In society, at assemblies, balls, and playhouses, these political young gentlemen are perpetually on the watch for a political illusion, or anything which can be tortured, or construed into being one, when, thrusting themselves into the very smallest openings for their favorite discourse, they fall upon the unhappy company tooth and nail. They have recently had many favorable opportunities of opening in churches, but as there the clergyman has it all his own way, and must not be contradicted, whatever politics he preaches, they are fain to hold their tongues until they reach the outer door, though at the imminent risk of bursting in the effort. As such discussions can please nobody but the talkative parties concerned, we hope they will henceforth take the hint and discontinue them, otherwise we now give them warning, that the ladies have our advice, to discountenance such talkers altogether. The domestic young gentleman. Let us make a slight sketch of our amiable friend, Mr. Felix Nixon. We are strongly disposed to think that if we put him in this place, he will answer our purpose without another word of comment. Felix, then, is a young gentleman who lives at home with his mother, just within the Twopenny Post Office circle of 3 miles from St. Martin-le-Grand. He wears indiarubber galoshes when the weather is at all damp, and always has a silk handkerchief neatly folded up in the right-hand pocket of his great coat, to tie over his mouth, when he goes home at night. Moreover, being rather near-sighted, he carries spectacles for particular occasions, and has a weakish tremulous voice, of which he makes great use, for he talks as much as any old lady breathing. The two chief subjects of Felix's discourse are himself and his mother, both of whom would appear to be very wonderful and interesting persons. As Felix and his mother are seldom apart in body, so Felix and his mother are scarcely ever separate in spirit. If you ask Felix how he finds himself today, he prefaces his reply with a long and minute bulletin of his mother's state of health. And the good lady in her turn, edifies her acquaintance with a circumstantial and alarming account, how he sneezed 4 times and coughed once after being out in the rain the other night, but having his feet promptly put into hot water, and his head into a flannel something, which we will not describe more particularly than by this delicate allusion, was happily brought round by the next morning, and enabled to go to business as usual. Our friend is not a very adventurous or hot-headed person, but he has passed through many dangers, as his mother can testify. There is one great story in particular, concerning a hackney coachman who wanted to overcharge him one night for bringing them home from the play, upon which Felix gave the aforesaid coachman a look which his mother thought would have crushed him to the earth, but which did not crush him quite, for he continued to demand another sixpence, notwithstanding that Felix took out his pocketbook, and, with the aid of a flat candle, pointed out the fair in print, which the coachman obstinately disregarding, he shut the street door with a slam which his mother shudders to think of. And then, roused to the most appalling pitch of passion by the coachman knocking a double knock to show that he was by no means convinced, he broke with uncontrollable force from his parent and the servant girl, and running into the street without his hat, actually shook his fist at the coachman, and came back again with a face as white, Mrs. Nixon says, looking about her for a simile, as white as that ceiling. She never will forget his fury that night, never. To this account Felix listens with a solemn face, occasionally looking at you to see how it affects you, and when his mother has made an end of it, adds that he looked at every coachman he met for 3 weeks afterwards, in hopes that he might see the scoundrel, whereupon Mrs. Nixon, with an exclamation of terror, requests to know what he would have done to him if he had seen him, at which Felix, smiling darkly and clenching his right fist, she exclaims, "Goodness gracious!" With a distracted air, and insists upon extorting a promise that he never will on any account do anything so rash, which her dutiful son, it being something more than 3 years since the offense was committed, reluctantly concedes, and his mother, shaking her head prophetically, fears with a sigh that his spirit will lead him into something violent yet. The discourse then, by an easy transition, turns upon the spirit which glows within the bosom of Felix, upon which point Felix himself becomes eloquent, and relates a thrilling anecdote of the time when he used to sit up till 2 o'clock in the morning reading French, and how his mother used to say, "Felix, you will make yourself ill, I know you will," and how he used to say, "Mother, I don't care, I will do it," and how at last his mother privately procured a doctor to come and see him, who declared, the moment he felt his pulse, that if he had gone on reading one night more, only one night more, he must have put a blister on each temple, and another between his shoulders, and who, as it was, sat down upon the instant, and writing a prescription for a blue pill, said it must be taken immediately, or he wouldn't answer for the consequences. The recital of these and many other moving perils of the like nature constantly harrows up the feelings of Mr. Nixon's friends. Mrs. Nixon has a tolerably extensive circle of female acquaintance, being a good-humored, talkative, bustling little body, and to the unmarried girls among them, she is constantly vaunting the virtues of her son, hinting that she will be a very happy person who wins him, but that they must mind their P's and Q's, for he is very particular, and terribly severe upon young ladies. At this last caution, the young ladies resident in the same row, who happen to be spending the evening there, put their pocket handkerchiefs before their mouths, and are troubled with a short cough. Just then Felix knocks at the door, and his mother, drawing the tea table nearer the fire, calls out to him as he takes off his boots in the back parlor that he needn't mind coming in his slippers, for there are only the two Miss Grays and Miss Thompson, and she is quite sure they will excuse him, and nodding to the two Miss Grays, she adds, in a whisper, that Julia Thompson is a great favorite with Felix, at which intelligence the short cough comes again, and Miss Thompson in particular is greatly troubled with it, till Felix coming in, very faint for want of his tea, changes the subject of discourse, and enables her to laugh out boldly, and tell Amelia Gray not to be so foolish. Here they all three laugh, and Mrs. Nixon says they are giddy girls, in which stage of the proceedings, Felix, who has by this time refreshened himself with the grateful herb that cheers but not inebriates, removes his cup from his countenance, and says with a knowing smile, that all girls are, whereat his admiring mama pats him on the back, and tells him not to be sly, which calls forth a general laugh from the young ladies, and another smile from Felix, who, thinking he looks very sly indeed, is perfectly satisfied. Tea being over, the young ladies resume their work, and Felix insists upon holding a skein of silk, while Miss Thompson winds it on a card. This process having been performed to the satisfaction of all parties, he brings down his flute in compliance with a request from the youngest Miss Gray, and plays divers tunes out of a very small music book till supper time, when he is very facetious and talkative indeed. Finally, after half a tumblerful of warm sherry and water, he gallantly puts on his galoshes over his slippers, and telling Miss Thompson's servant to run on first, and get the door open, escorts that young lady to her house, five doors off. The Miss Grays who live in the next house, but one stopping to peep with merry faces from their own door till he comes back again, when they call out very well, Mr. Felix, apostrophe and trip into the passage with a laugh more musical than any flute that was ever played. Felix is rather prim in his appearance, and perhaps a little priggish about his books and flute, and so forth, which have all their peculiar corners of peculiar shelves in his bedroom. Indeed, all his female acquaintance, and they are good judges, have long ago set him down as a thorough old bachelor. He is a favorite with them, however, in a certain way, as an honest, inoffensive, kind-hearted creature, and as his peculiarities harm nobody, not even himself, we are induced to hope that many who are not personally acquainted with him will take our good word in his behalf, and be content to leave him to a long continuance of his harmless existence. The censorious young gentleman. There is an amiable kind of young gentleman going about in society, upon whom, after much experience of him, and considerable turning over of the subject in our mind, we feel it our duty to affix the above appellation. Young ladies mildly call him a sarcastic young gentleman, or a severe young gentleman. We, who know better, beg to acquaint them with the fact that he is merely a censorious young gentleman, and nothing else. The censorious young gentleman has the reputation among his familiars of a remarkably clever person, which he maintains by receiving all intelligence and expressing all opinions with a dubious sneer, accompanied with a half-smile, expressive of anything you please but good humor. This sets people about thinking what on earth the censorious young gentleman means, and they speedily arrive at the conclusion that he means something very deep indeed. For they reason in this way: this young gentleman looks so very knowing that he must mean something, and as I am by no means a dull individual, what a very deep meaning he must have, if I can't find it out. ... It is extraordinary how soon a censorious young gentleman may make a reputation in his own small circle, if he bear this in his mind, and regulate his proceedings accordingly. As young ladies are generally not curious, but laudably desirous to acquire information, the censorious young gentleman is much talked about among them, and many surmises are hazarded regarding him. I wonder, exclaims the eldest Miss Greenwood, laying down her work to turn up the lamp, I wonder whether Mr. Fairfax will ever be married. Bless me, dear, cries Miss Marshall, whatever made you think of him? Really I hardly know, replies Miss Greenwood. He is such a very mysterious person, that I often wonder about him. Well, to tell you the truth, replies Miss Marshall, and so do one. Here two other young ladies profess that they are constantly doing the like, and all present appear in the same condition except one young lady, who, not scrupling to state that she considers Mr. Fairfax a horror, draws down all the opposition of the others, which having been expressed in a great many ejaculatory passages, such as, well, did I ever? And lore, Emily, dear. Ma takes up the subject, and gravely states that she must say she does not think Mr. Fairfax by any means a horror, but... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.